Welcome to Holden Media Ministry. This is a tape by Michael Wilker. Today's date is June 12th, 1998. The call number on this tape is WIM98-4. The title is This Land Is Whose Land. Let's listen in.
Under the topic, This Land Is Whose Land. You might know that old song from the 70s. This land is your, or actually it's from earlier than that, isn't it? This land is your land, this land is my land. From California, that's where I live. To the New York Islands, that's where I used to live. From the Redwood Forest to the
Gulf Stream
waters, I've never lived there. I grew up in Minnesota on a hog farm. And that's where I feel most rooted. A lot of times I feel like there's this umbilical cord that goes between me and wherever I'm living and all the way back to where my parents and my brother live in southern Minnesota. But that umbilical cord has been disrupted recently because, as some of you have heard before, just a couple weeks ago, my brother, because of a burdensome debt load, decided to sell the farm that was my dad's farm and then his farm too, and was bought by my grandfather for my father. And that's the first time, this will be the first time in four generations that there's no one in our direct line of descendants working on the land. My brother has decided to get a job working for the Park and Recreation Service in town. Grooming softball diamonds. So I guess he's kind of working on the land, but it's not his land, and he's getting a wage for it rather than being able to gain a living from the produce that he's able to grow there. And I'm telling you that story quite kind of rationally and plainly. There's a lot of emotion involved in it. My family is talking about it like grief, and it's a lot of conflict between my parents and my brother and his wife. And I live in California now, in Watsonville, California, about 90 miles south of San Francisco. And I'm a long ways away from it. But like I said, that umbilical cord was kind of an anchor back there. And it's all kind of new to me still, so I'm not sure how that's gonna emotionally affect me or change how I think about who I am. I used to always introduce myself by saying I grew up on a hog farm in southern Minnesota, and it was always a good connection to me still, because my brother was still farming that same land and he was still continuing, so I felt it was still, you know, kind of authentic to say that in a certain way. My family was still related to the farm, and maybe it's still authentic, but it's a questioning that I'm going to be going through. I'd like to open it up by asking us to have a little bit of a large group discussion here with a question. What things do you own? What things do you own that help give you life? What are some of the basic things that you own that give you life?
Well, we own our homes, provide shelter, as I told you the other night, like you, I grew up on a farm, and that's home in a way. But we've lived where we live now for 22 years, and our kids have gone through school and grown and left as adults, so it's a special place.
So you and perhaps some of the rest of us own homes. What are some of the other things that we own?
Groceries.
Groceries? Yes, we own food. That's a very important aspect. We own food, and it's our food. It gives us life. What about anything else? Yes.
Well, my father came from Denmark, and Danish things are very precious to me. The way we worshiped, which is different. And I thought about it when we were talking about exorcism one night. Uh-huh. And whenever we confessed the Apostles' Creed, we prefaced it by saying, I renounce the devil and all his works and all his ways. Mm-hmm. And another thing we did in the absolution of sins previous to having the Eucharist or the Holy Communion, we went up to the altar, and the pastor would lay his hand on one and the other and say, I declare unto you the forgiveness of all your sins in the name of the triune God, and the next person. And then we went back, and then we came back up for the wine and the bread. Those things are precious, and all kinds of Danish other things are foods, music, art.
They give you life.
Yes.
In a way. They sustain, they provide.
Well, that's part of who I am, I think.
Yes. And I also appreciate that you brought up baptism or the remembrance of our baptism when we confess the Apostles' Creed and sharing of Holy Communion, because that is one of the ways that I think God redeems our life. So that here in a few of these things that we've been talking about, God provides our life, God redeems our life, God sustains our life. There's kind of at least three ways that God is working to give us life. So far we've said homes and food. And I'm going to put what you were saying about so-called Danish things in this category over here.
Danish. I've been there.
To Denmark.
I'm going to put that as culture and
hymns.
Religious faith.
Uh-huh.
Or traditions.
Hence, Christensen Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What else do you own? Homes, food, culture, religious traditions?
Cars. Yeah.
Cars? Okay. Do you think, now as you see me putting things in these two categories, do you think that it should go in homes and food or in culture, religious traditions?
The left.
Why in this part?
It's something that's sustaining.
Do you think, is it a basic?
Where it is.
Where you live it is, yes. Good. Good. In some places, cars aren't a basic necessity, but in some places, in order to have life, practically, you need to have a car so that you can get from one place or another.
Our attitude is our very own, the way we feel about things, and a lot of times that can't be changed.
Right. That's your personality.
Mm-hmm.
You own your personality, your attitudes, your emotions. Those are yours, mm-hmm. and they can't be taken away. That's kind of in another category that I'm not going to put up on the board right now, but I'll talk about it a little bit later.
Okay.
You had your hand.
Like some things of your parents, like my mother's wedding ring.
Uh-huh.
You know, I have that, and then I'm going to pass it on to my daughter. And if anything, if I lose it or anything, you know, I feel really terrible. I don't know if that has...
Is that a basic thing that you need to have life? Or would you put that in as things that make your life good?
Yeah. Well,
how would you know
how to explain that?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have many things. Like, I had a piano and a violin.
Uh-huh.
The piano I had... my parents bought for me when I was a child, and through circumstances in my life, mm-hmm. they were sold.
Yeah.
And then after my husband died, I thought, what am I going to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out and bought a violin and was given an organ
mm-hmm.
from an elderly. So it seems like I almost got those things back.
Yeah.
But they were, at the time, part of me left. Because they were very important.
Right, very important to you. But you still were able to live.
Yeah.
So I would put like the rings of your mother.
What about family heirlooms?
Family heirlooms and the instruments, music. In this category. Other things I would put under here. Oh, yes.
Like my faith.
Your faith?
No, it goes under the other.
Under the other? Why? I was going to run over there.
Well, because I need it to live. I mean, I don't know why I would... I mean, I do really think I need it to live.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a basic
it's
trust.
It's life, yeah. I don't know what it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been through depression, and if it, you know, I mean, I couldn't live, I don't think.
Good. All right. Someone else had their hand up, too.
Well, I was just going to say pets.
Pets. Do you think over here or over here?
Probably on
pets the over here.
I own them. They own me.
Yes. And since you brought up animals, I guess I would put the hogs, too, up here, which are not pets necessarily.
But they were sustenance, too.
But the hogs, yeah. That kind of goes under food. The hogs over here, that's right.
So they were sold for
financial stability. Mm-hmm. You have to have something to, at my age, to live on for the rest of your life.
Yes. Which gives you, the financial stability gives you access to food and shelter and clothing.
Addition, yeah.
Yeah. Clothing. I'm kind of making these two lists because in Western European and American societies, we've developed a concept that there's two types of property, and we view those types of property a little bit differently. This type of property is personal, you might say. Even though that can be personal too, this is exclusive. It means that nobody else can take the clothes that I need to live. I need a certain amount of clothes that I need to live, or else I'm going to die. And no one can take those things away from me, because that's an exclusive right that we've developed in our tradition. Faith is not quite the same thing, but food or shelter also fall into those basic things that I have an exclusive right that no one can take my bed. I need my bed. Then there was a second kind of property, and this goes all the way back to Rome, to the Roman Empire and all, and its tradition has grown. The other type of property is kind of stuff that I need access to for my livelihood, for my ability to make it through the day, in a sense. And it was oftentimes thought of as being in common. This stuff was not only yours only, but other people had a certain access to it. It was inclusive. And what we did in the Western tradition from the Roman Empire all the way up to today, well, up to, I should say, about the 17th century. I'm going to make a break around the 17th century. What we did is we said that basically everybody has a right to this. Certain people have rights to this. Everybody should be able to have it, but how we initially defined who has rights to these things was the emperor or the king or some kind of land owner. And you could only have land because you had either some sort of inheritance that came down that was able to be enforced by law, whichever law you were living under, because you had the physical strength or military muscle in order to keep people out of your property and land, or because you had some divine right, like the emperors were saying, this is my property, or the kings of ancient Israel, this land is all my land. Whose land is it? Mine, said the king. And so it doesn't matter if you happen to be living in a house over there, that house is basically on the king's land. That kind of still operates in a way in England, where they still have a monarchy. When I was camping over there once, my wife and I went, and there was this beautiful old castle where Queen Elizabeth used to use for one of her summer, not not Queen Elizabeth II that we know of, but the first Queen Elizabeth. She used it as one of her summer castles. And we went, we needed a place to camp, and there was no campground in that area. But there was this beautiful expanse of land around the castle, like a whole big, huge park. And there were cows on it and everything. So we knocked on the door of the house near the castle, and we asked, can we camp back there? And the woman said, oh no, that's Queensland. That's the Queensland. It's land that she has access to, even though she never probably has seen it. But it's her land, and so no one can go on it and use it. So we camped in that lady's front yard, so we could camp on the individual woman's little personal property there. But the Queen has, used to anyway, in the constitutional monarchy that they have now, it's not so easy. But the Queen or the King could confiscate any of the land that they wanted to for their own use. This kind of land and resources was something that you needed in order to do your work. Like here, this is stuff that you need to get by just to live. But here, you need land so that you can plant your crops and so that you can grow the corn. Or you needed land so that you could mine the ore that's inside of it. And that was your livelihood, one of the ways that you gained your livelihood. So you needed access to that land. And it was seen as being in common. And in the 17th century, folks are trying to be free of kings and lords. You know, that's 17th century is when the United States Revolution happened. And up till then, folks are trying to figure out how can we free ourselves from the domination of these kings and lords who think that they get all the land and we have no access to it. We have no personal property rights. So what they did is they created the market economy, which we live in right now. They started to see that as being a way where I am able to own my own personal private property, and no one else can take that away from me unless I exchange something with them. So then I can sell my land in exchange for money or gold or some other thing. But that is, I should be totally free to make that decision about my property. So that meant that the king or the state government couldn't come in and say, okay, you've got to give up your land and can take it away from me without having an exchange. In the 17th century and the founding of the United States, we said, no, each individual can have personal property rights, and that if that is going to be exchange, it has to be exchanged. It can't be taken away. If it's taken away without a compensation or an exchange, that's injustice. So that freed us from the domination of the state and of the kings. But what it did is it threw all of these things over here, including the land, into being called a commodity. That the only way that it had any value was if it could be exchanged in the market. And you can only exchange things that you have exclusive rights to. So let's just go back a second. Under the kings and the other control, I couldn't exchange the land that I was living on because it wasn't exclusively mine. The king had rights to it, so I couldn't sell the king's land. But because I lived in the kingdom, it was the king's, and hopefully if he was a benevolent king, that land was used for everybody's common good in the kingdom. But if it was a bad king, it didn't work that way. So when we set up personal private property rights, that land then becomes exclusively mine. And so this is no longer inclusive up here, but exclusive. Now, to demonstrate what a big shift that is, think about the air. Who owns the air? Who owns the air? What?
God does.
God does, from our faith tradition, yes. But who owns the air?
It's no one. Congress. No, it's no one, it's all.
Well,
are you talking about airspace?
Well, there's air. This is one thing, is airspace. That in these property rights laws, any air above the property that I own is mine too. So I own the property that is above my house in Watsonville. And now in the United States, because we've got air travel and things like that, we've developed a law that says that only goes up so high. Okay. But let's take air one. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's quite a consideration in the new buildings that are going up, mm-hmm. that are high, and they have to buy their airspace.
Mm-hmm. And why do they have to buy their airspace? Let's say a little bit more about
that. You're not allowed to shadow another building.
Yeah.
Or so that's you have to right. pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Or access or anything.
Yeah.
So if you, when you negotiate for that piece of ground, you negotiate for the air rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. Another thing is that, so now we actually do have a market for air, because air space can be exchanged on the market. It didn't used to be that way, but it is now. Another thing, well, here, one of the ways that in the Bush and then the Clinton administrations, we started to think about how we deal with pollution, air pollution, is that people can sell their air pollution credits. That if my electrical power plant over here is producing more pollution in the air than is legally acceptable, I can exchange my dirty air, sell my dirty air, or actually it's I need to buy clean air, that's what I'm doing. If I'm at a dirty power plant, then I can buy clean air from a clean energy supply source. So for example, if I'm burning coal over here in my power plant, that creates a lot of dirty air pollution. But if in this power plant owned by somebody else, I'm burning natural gas, which produces very little air pollution, I can, the federal government has set up an air pollution market now, so that I can buy clean air from this clean energy source to offset this energy source over here.
In other words, you can still produce that dirty air because you bought some clean air over here?
Yeah.
It's a way. It's going to get more expensive all the time.
Yeah, it will get more expensive because this air is going to be more and more scarce. That clean air will be more and more scarce, so the price will go up. So then it'll be a financial incentive, is what we're thinking, is that clean air is going to be too expensive at some point for me to keep on buying it. So I'm going to have to put scrubbers in my smokestacks to take some of the pollution out, so I don't have as much pollution going out. So it's a way to give a financial incentive. Either you have to buy the clean air, or you have to reduce your own pollution. That's how we're thinking about how to have pollution work in this market economy.
I don't understand how you can buy air.
Well, the reason that you can buy and sell anything is only dependent upon the relationships and activities. It's not really dependent upon the thing. You know, think about money. You know, people are buying and selling money all over the place, all over the world. And we don't usually do that because we're using money to buy things. But there is this huge system that just is exchanging money electronically. There's not really any things that they're buying and selling. The only reason it exists, though, is because there's certain relationships and agreements between banks and governments, and those things, that money is not tied to any specific thing any longer. It used to be tied in the United States to gold, and to the price of gold, but it's not. The value of our dollar is not dependent on any one thing or item any longer. So that's why we can buy air, you know. Water. there's water is very scarce in California. And one person said that if you look at the politics of the United States, it's really the history of water control. That happened in, I was talking to my wife's uncle, who grew up in Oklahoma, and he said that power there was, the reason you used power was to get access to the water underneath your ground or that's coming down river so that you could feed your cattle. And that's how politics worked where he grew up. In California, it's the same thing in some ways. So we have water markets. That's an idea that's being suggested, is that if you live in an area that has a lot of water, that can be the state, it's being suggested, can set up a market so that you can buy water and sell it to another place. And then that will hopefully, like the pollution air credits, create incentives for water conservation and other things too. So, but we've put all of this stuff that used to be in common into an exclusive property right. Now when things are exclusive, it means that other people can't have access to it. Eventually, if you use up the land that you initially had by debt or expense or because you got sick and you needed to pay someone for the doctor or something like that, then you have to sell your land, and eventually your land gets smaller and smaller, and then you don't have anything left except for your own body. Then your body is also becomes something that can be bought and sold in the market exchange. This exclusive right to your body then becomes something that you can sell on the market. That's called labor. And so we have labor markets. You know, if you have a really rare skill, like you can be a brain surgeon, the market for that is very high. So you get a lot of money for selling that skill or that kind of part of your body. If you chop wood, you have to do and expend a lot of effort in your body, but you might not get as much return on that selling of that skill or of your body. We're going to talk about that labor exchange and how we sell our bodies in this market economy tomorrow, when we talk about the blessing and call to work. That a little bit. I'm going to hopefully bring it around to some hopeful things there. So this has meant that things that used to be in common, though, are now exclusive. And so that means that people that don't have any rights to them. If they're unemployed, if they're homeless, if they're poor, they don't have rights to the things that they might need for their livelihood. Other things under here could be education, it could be tools, like say that they're a carpenter, but they have the skill to do carpentry work, but they don't have the tools. They might have to rent it from somebody else. But tools for their work, all those things, they no longer can have access to. Think about it here at Holden Village. We have a lot of things in common here that help us get through the day. We have some of those personal exclusive things, like I come here and I still own my shirt. And in, but a lot of the other things I have common access to so that I can do my work here. This room in which I'm teaching is held in common by the whole community. And I have access to it so that I can teach. They're building a new, on one of the homes up there, they're building a new porch. And the carpenter, in order to make his livelihood, has access to the tools. He doesn't own those tools. He doesn't own anything that he's working with. But he has access to them. So in Holden, we've kind of got a little bit of this common property still. It's an inclusive access that I can have rights to. But in our market economy, I would have to buy those things or rent those things. I don't have access automatically to them. So how about questions about these two types of property and what's happened? Do you have any questions so far or comments? Now, let's see. I wanted to I'm going to erase this. I'm going to shift gears. Because I want to look at how God would have us think about these things through the Bible. And how many confirmed people do I have here? Raise your hand. How many of you have been confirmed?
I've
been confirmed.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Confirmed.
So you all studied the Bible then? Okay. I hope this is going to be fairly easy, but what I want you to help me do is to reconstruct the story of the Bible. And one of the ways that we can look at the story as a whole that's in the Bible is a story between being on the land and being landless. Being at home, somehow, and being homeless. Okay? So I'll start us off, or maybe that's the easiest thing. Where does the story of the Bible start? The Garden of Eden, yes. So I'm going to put this under the home and landed category. So the Garden of Eden. Then what happens?
We got booted out of Eden.
We got booted out of Eden.
So they were homeless.
Mm-hmm. We were homeless, got booted out of Eden. But God still, Adam and Eve still had land, remember? Adam was going to till the soil, even though it was going to be by the sweat of his brow. So they still had some access to land. But the history of Cain and Abel, and then of their descendants, and of the people at Noah's time, all move to doing everything they can to lose the land. And so, from Noah to the Tower of Babel, they lose their land, and it ends up, what happens after the Tower of Babel? Who's the next person or people that show up on the scene?
Noah.
Well, that would be in here, Noah. After the Tower of Babel.
Abraham.
Abraham. Right. And Abraham, one of the ways that they talk about, he was a wandering Aramean, right? He was a sojourner. So he had a home. But God came to him and said, come, leave your home, leave your father's home, and come to a land that I promised for you. This was, Abraham and Sarah didn't have any land when they left. They left their inheritance and that security, and they trusted on faith, Jane, in the promise that they were going to receive a land, that promised land. So Abraham and Sarah, and they journeyed for a long distance, and their children, Isaac and his family and Jacob, were all kind of sojourners on the land. So sojourning is one way of being on the land. Sojourning. You know, in American history, there's a woman named Sojourner Truth. She was an African-American who was a slave, but she knew that there was freedom in the North. And so she would help and was leading people by the promise of freedom. So Sojourner is someone who has their eyes on the promised land. So these folks, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, had their eyes on the promised land. But they were sojourning. Then, what happens to Jacob's son? Joseph.
He's taken to Egypt.
He's taken to Egypt. And in that process, Joseph is comes over here to home and landed, because even though he's sold into slavery, he becomes able to, the Pharaoh, after the great story of him saving the nation of Egypt because of the famine and the plenty that Joseph has stored up for the nation, Joseph is given a whole bunch of land for him and his family. And they're given the best land. Joseph and his descendants and family are given the best land in Egypt. So they become landed. But you know what happens? What happens?
They all become slaves.
Yeah, but how do they become slaves? A really interesting story that I never really realized. Let's see. Last days of Jacob. Okay. There was another famine. Now there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe. The land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph collected all the money to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. When the money from the land of Egypt and from the land of Canaan was spent, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone." And Joseph answered, "Give me your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock, if your money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. That year he supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock. When that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, "We cannot hide from my lord that our money is all spent, and the herds of our cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land." They're offering their own bodies and their land in exchange for food. With our land, will become slaves to Pharaoh. Just give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. And all the people living in Egypt sold their fields because the famine was severe upon them. And the land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made slaves of them, from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy. So the priests were saved, because the Pharaoh's priests, in order for the Pharaoh to do this, he needs someone to say, "It's a blessing by God." But the people needed food. They needed, remember, in this category, they needed that basic stuff to live. So they started selling everything that they had. And finally they got down to their very bodies and they sold themselves into slavery. So they were landed and they ended up in slavery anyway. So they end up in slavery. But you know what happens next.
Moses appears.
Moses comes. Moses, a slave too. Moses brings them, or helps liberate them from slavery in Egypt, takes them out of the household of Pharaoh, it says, into the household of freedom. But they don't get to the promised land right away, do they? What do they do first?
Wander.
40 years.
They're wanderers, yep. And I'm wilderness wanderers. Now this experience though was not as promising, you might say, as Abraham and Sarah's experience. In the Bible, when we get to this part in the wilderness, what's the thing that you remember most about how the Israelites were feeling and acting and behaving.
They were disobedient.
They were disobedient.
Take us back to Egypt.
Take us back to Egypt. They were not hopeful. They wanted to go back to Egypt because they were worried that they weren't going to get the food. God gave them manna every morning so that they would have a basic sustenance. But they didn't trust as much in the promise of God. They're being crunched with survival every day, really kind of dimmed their view or their hope in the promised land. So wanderers, this kind of experience, even though it was homelessness, it wasn't so much that they had their eyes on the promised land, but survival dims hope in the promised land. This is another experience. Just because it's in this category doesn't mean that every experience of homelessness is the same. You can be homeless and be kind of full of joy because you're in expectation and hope for what has been promised to you. Or you can be wandering and you can be disillusioned because it doesn't look like you're ever going to get to the promised land. But eventually they do. At least their descendants do. And they get into the promised land. And at first they make a federation of tribes. But then, that doesn't go so well. Everybody else has what that they want? A king. So they set up a monarchy. And you remember when the people come to Samuel, who was the prophet at that time, when the people came to Samuel and said, "We want a king." And Samuel said to God, "Okay, your people want a king. What should I say?" You remember what God said to Samuel? Was God, "Oh, great, this is going to be great. You're going to love a king." No. God says to Samuel, "All right, you know, if they want a king, they can have a king. But tell them ahead of time that your king is going to take your daughters and is going to make him servants and slaves in his household. Tell the people that the king is going to take your sons and make them soldiers and give up their lives in his wars. Tell them that they're going to have to give their blood and sweat so that they will build his homes and temples." So God, through Samuel, warns them right at the outset, but they still want a king. So they get David. And David seems to be a pretty good guy. He wrote a lot of the Psalms that we were studying this week in our Bible study. But you know, one of the main things that I remember about David is that he committed adultery with Bathsheba, killed her husband, or had him killed in the war, and then took Bathsheba for his own wife. He committed adultery because of his kingly power. He was able to have dominion over somebody else and take it. And the prophet Nathan comes to David and tells a story about if someone takes someone else's sheep, what would you do to that person? Oh, that person should die. So Nathan sees what David is doing is related in a way to the land, to someone's property, taking it away. Solomon, David's son, does this on a massive scale. The biblical record shows that Solomon, they didn't quite call it slavery, but almost put his people in servitude so that they could build that beautiful, gorgeous temple that we read about. But that cost so many people their own livelihoods that they became in servitude to the king. And so while Solomon, we can kind of think of this beautiful, glorious time, Solomon started a process where people were in bondage again to their own kings. And then the history of kings of Israel was, except for a couple of exceptions, you know, just corruption upon corruption upon corruption, that finally led to them being
exile.
In exile.
You can, we once did a Bible study here, looking at this part of history, and there's a way that even though the people are moving back and forth here between being at home and landed and being homeless and landless, that God continues to keep giving them promise and pulling them through. And so even though they've got a bunch of cruddy kings here, God is still saying, but I'm going to be with you. I'll bring you through. God is also warning them at the same time, too, and warning them that if they keep on going this way, this is the path they're going to end up at. But so they're in exile in Babylon. And I guess to be consistent, I should put exile in blue, too. Now, exile, this is when what you had your land, and you lost it. That's not even, you don't even have a dim hope of the land, but you had it, and you lost it totally. Have you ever had that experience of losing something that was so important to you? It's depressing, it's despairing. Going back to my brother's story, he was going through a terrible time this whole year in such terrible depression, and kind of kept that to himself. It's very, very dark time in a person's life when what they had is lost and they're in exile. And yet, it was in exile that the people in that despair and darkness, that God brought them this abundant promise that was renewed and proclaimed with such clarity that I just want to read you part of it. Where's my? From Isaiah. This is while they're in exile. They have this promise, though, that's renewed. No more shall there be in the land an infant that lives but for a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. For one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth, and one who falls short of 100 years will be considered accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord, and their descendants as well. So in the exile experience, though, is while it's despairing, it's renewed hope. In despair. So eventually, the folks in exile, the Babylonians are conquered by the Persians, and the Persians say, okay, folks in exile, you can go home to Jerusalem. So they go back, but it's not a monarchy anymore. It's not like the nation of old, because they still have their Persian overlords. But they do have a little community. Around Jerusalem. And Ezra and Nehemiah, what they, from that experience of the kings and the power of the kings not being able to secure the land because of their faithlessness and their injustice, Ezra and Nehemiah, the leaders of Israel at that time, come up with an idea that, well, if we are religiously and rigorously obedient to God, if we have a sense of purity, so they developed holiness codes and recovered the temple worship, and so they thought that if they could just be pure enough, if they could just be religious enough, that then they would secure the land. This was power, political power. But that didn't do it either. Because later on comes the Roman Empire, and first of all, other folks, and then the Roman Empire. And by 70 AD, the Jews, in this tradition of purity and rigorous obedience, totally lose the temple and the city of Jerusalem. So the nation of Israel, or the people of Israel, go into landlessness and homelessness. Pretty permanent. The diaspora spreads Jews all across the Mediterranean area, and they don't have a home that they can call themselves. Now, that experience of homelessness over the centuries has given a lot of gifts to the Jewish folks, and those gifts have been given to us. In fact, there's a book in the bookstore that's on the central table as you walk in. Jane works in the bookstore, so I'm looking at her. It's called Gifts of
the Jews.
Just Gifts of the Jews. Mm-hmm. So you can read that and find out how that sense of homelessness helped inspire the Jews, and their gifts have been given to the rest of the world through that. Now, what about Jesus? Because I've just taken you through kind of the nation of Israel, and Jesus is coming up here. What are some ways that Jesus talks about being, having land and property, or being homeless and without property? What are some ways that Jesus does that?
Well, he himself said he had no place to lay his head, to, as though that he did not have property.
Right.
As an adult.
Right. That's we don't know exactly about Jesus' economic life, but at least he traveled a lot and he didn't have a place to lay his head. He had a sense of homelessness in the world. Okay? So he positioned himself over here. What did he say about other people? How did he call?
Well, did they say something about the land? I can't forget what he called it. But after so many years, the land should revert back.
Well, that was the Jubilee laws of the Hebrews before.
That's good. That was in Leviticus. It was especially, even though it's in the first part of the Bible, the folks at Ezra and Nehemiah's time recovered those laws from Leviticus. And the Leviticus laws said that, every seventh year you should let your land lie fallow so that you can let the land rejuvenate itself. But every 50th year, after you've done all this exchanging of your land, and some people have no land anymore, and other people have a whole bunch of land, after the generations go, every 50th year, that should all be reverted to the original family owners. So that every 50th year, the Jubilee year, you all get to start over equal again. So if you had 10 acres at the beginning, you get 10 acres again after 50 years. So that's called Jubilee, and that's in Leviticus chapter 25. Is one of God's laws. So in some ways, though, Jesus did refer to this because he was talking about giving up your property. You've heard the story about the rich man?
Yeah, unless you give up everything that you have and follow me, you do not inherit the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting. There's a kind of concept of land that Jesus is talking about in there as well, the kingdom of God. Jesus has an understanding that the property that we own, the land that we own, all that stuff that we own here, is a gift. Jesus understands that as a gift that God has given to us, and that we, by God's grace, can give away, that we can share that with other people. He always is asking people to think about how you give things away. The story of the fishes and loaves, it's the little kid that has five fish and two loaves, right? I should. Okay.
Five loaves and two fish.
Five loaves and two fish. Thank you. I got that mixed up. Five loaves and two fish. And so this kid is asked to give it away, and the 5,000 people eat. But it's also, Jesus is offering us the kingdom, is offering us the promised land. All right? Jesus, I think, had a concept that this land, this new heaven and earth that's coming into being, is not only something in the air, but it's connected to land too. It's not just airspace, but it's heaven and earth. And so the kingdom of God has something to do with a new household, a new earth being common and available to all again. It's like that Jubilee, that we're all going to have access to the things that we need for livelihood. In the book of Hebrews, there's a lot of talk about, or a lot of writing in there, about once we were homeless, but now we have a home. And in the book of Revelation of Jesus Christ, the last book in the Bible, it says, the home of God is among mortals. So there's this sense that God is going to be dwelling with us. And the word that's used for home in that last book of the Bible is called tabernacle. Now, where did folks have a tabernacle?
When they were in Jerusalem.
Wandering.
When they were in the wilderness. Yeah. Because once, and they had the tabernacle for a while during David's reign, but once they built that temple, then they didn't have a tabernacle anymore. The tabernacle is the tent of meeting, so that you could pick it up and you could go wherever the people were going. So God is saying, my home is to be wherever my people are moving and going. And so Jesus and Jesus' disciples give us an idea of property or land as a gift for life. And that is most embodied by Jesus Christ himself being a gift of God's very own life for us so that we might have life. Now, a gift, you've heard it said, you know, if you love someone, you got to give it away, or you got to keep on giving that gift of love in order for the love to keep on living. That's like Jesus Christ. Jesus is a gift, and we need to keep on giving the gift of Jesus away to other people in order for that gift to continue to be a living gift, a living word. So, to conclude, this is a way to think about all of our property, all of our possessions, the land that we have, is as gift. That's how Jesus would have us. As gift that we have, promised to us, but gift that we can give away and share. That's the ethic or the way of life that Jesus is calling us to. I'm going to conclude by playing two songs that are also in a CD in the bookstore called Dancing the Harvest. It's a group of new songs by Ray McKeever. You might know him from the Midwest, and he's done things in other places too. He's been here at Holden Village a couple of times. The first song I'll play is Give It Away. And it starts, you've heard the story about the rich man? I kind of threw that in earlier for you.
Have you heard the story about the rich man? Give it away, give it away. Who asked Jesus how to get to the promised land? Give it away, give it away. Well, he had kept all the commandments, everyone. Give it away, give it away. There was just one thing that he had never done. Give it away.